The word spirituality has a Latin root, to breathe. And when I think of that word, I think about breathing. I think about the experience of taking a deep breath and feeling refreshed, feeling that oxygen coming into my lungs and going into my bloodstream and giving my body energy again. Well, spirituality is that kind of religious experience of feeling a sense that your life is renewed and given purpose and have a, and given strength and energy through that religious experience. There are many ways to achieve that, but one of them is through music. Now, the Roman Catholic tradition, before the Reformation, the worship service of the Mass did not include the congregation singing. There may have been chants that priests would say, but the congregation actually, if you visit the cathedrals in Europe, there were no chairs, and they might mill around at Notre Dame Cathedral, for example, and in the distance would be the priests performing their ritual Mass. But it wasn't. There was no central focus of music in the service. One of the things that Martin Luther did when he created the Reformation in Europe was to introduce congregational singing and introduce more music in the service. Martin Luther was never diplomatic. He put it this way. A person who does not regard music as a marvelous creation of God must be a clodhopper. Indeed. And does not deserve to be called a human being. He should be permitted to hear nothing but the braying of asses and the grunting of hogs. Well, now, following Martin Luther's example, in England, when John Wesley founded the Methodist Church, he encouraged congregational singing. He wrote in the year 1700, "Beware of singing as if you were half dead or half asleep. Lift up your voice with strength." One of seven rules he wrote about singing hymns. Of course, we Unitarian Universalists have our own rule, which is stop reading ahead to see if you agree with the words. In America, churches have introduced into worship classical music, gospel music, folk music, jazz music, and rock music. I love it all. I love it all. But my personal favorite is the cello. It started when I was 14, a freshman in high school at West Phoenix High School. And my counselor had me sign up for an elective course, and I chose beginning orchestra. I had an idea. I wanted to learn to play the drums. I love the sound of the drum, the beating, the beat, the energy. I thought of though the great drummers in jazz bands and in rock concerts, and I'll learn the drums. So I went to the first class, and Mr. Philibaum, the music teacher at the school, went around to each of us who were there and said, "Well, one at a time, tell me what instrument you want to learn to play." And he got to Roger and said, "What do you want to play?" And I said, "My dream is to learn to play the drums in the orchestra." And he said, "We have lots of drummers. You look like a cellist to me." "Come here, Roger." And he took me over to this rack of student cellos. And he picked one up and he held it up and he showed it to me. He said, "Isn't this, look how beautiful this instrument is. The cello is marvelous. It is, of all the instruments in the orchestra, the one that comes closest to reproducing the sound of the human voice, the range of the human voice." Just imagine the beautiful sounds you can produce if you learn to play this. And I know you can do it, he said. I'm confident just looking at you. Well, at 14, anyone who showed any faith in me at all had a lot of power over me. When you're young and somebody says, you can do this, I know you can, it's important to hear that. So my parents were a little surprised that evening when I came home carrying a student cello, since I had never expressed any interest in the cello before. But my mother was actually kind of thrilled with this, that I would be interested in the string instrument and playing in an orchestra. So she called the Phoenix Symphony and asked for the names of cellists in the orchestra who were looking for students. They actually had a brand new first cellist who had come from Boston, a young Japanese man named Taki Atsumi. And they said, he's just moved here. He has no students at all. Your son could be his first student. And she got the phone number and called him, and we had an appointment, and I went to his home, and he gave me my first lesson. And this was the beginning of a 3-year relationship. Taki Atsumi was amazingly patient with someone like me who had no talent at all. He taught me about things like discipline and the importance of practice, the art of cello playing, the art of any skill that you need to develop requires a certain amount of concentration and discipline and a willingness to try and to work hard, and Taki taught me about that. I got to know his family. I would come over, and at the beginning he was charging $6, but as he became more and more successful as a cello teacher and had more and more students, he continued to teach me at the low rate, and then I would actually do work at his house, mow the grass and things like that, to compensate for the fact that he wasn't charging me as much as his other students. So I developed a friendship with his family. It was a wonderful experience. But I was no good as a cellist. What I did learn was the names and the skills of great cellists. I learned about Mieczysław Rostropowicz, who actually came to Phoenix and played a concert. I learned about Jacqueline Dupree, the amazing European cellist, young woman. And I learned about a man named Pablo Casals. And that's what I want to talk about more this morning. Pablo Casals was born just outside Barcelona in 1876. He was one of 11 children. His mother was from Puerto Rico. His father was a Spanish church organist who also gave piano and singing lessons. Casals' father did not believe his son could earn a living as a musician. He knew from experience how hard it was to make a living as a musician. And all young musicians hear this, I think, from their parents. This is not an easy way to make a living. Casals' father thought it would be more practical for Pablo to have a trade, and he made plans for the boy to learn carpentry and be a carpenter's assistant. However, Casals' mother was convinced that her son had a future as a musician. And because of her determination, at the age of 11, the boy went to Barcelona to learn the cello and to study music. There he stayed with some distant relatives, a carpenter and his wife. And after 6 months, the boy, who is now 12 years old, had made sufficient progress in playing the cello, a half-sized cello, that he got a job playing in a cafe. Word spread about the skill of this child cellist. Business in the cafe increased. In his free time, the boy explored this port city of Barcelona. He was supposed to be at the cafe on the dot at 9 p.m., but he was often late. Finally, the owner of the cafe gave Casals his first watch. One afternoon, when Casals was 13, his father came to visit him in Barcelona. a visit that Casals never forgot. That day, his father brought his son his first full-time cello. Then they stopped at an old music shop near the harbor to look for music for the cello. And Casals wrote about that experience. He said, "I began to browse through a bunch of music scores. Suddenly, I came upon a sheaf of papers, crumbling and discolored with age. They were the unaccompanied suites by John Sebastian Bach for the cello only. I looked at them with wonder. 6 suites for violoncello solo. What magic and mystery, I wondered, were hidden in these words. I had never heard of the existence of the suites. Nobody, not even my teachers, had ever mentioned them to me. I forgot our reason for being in the shop. All I could do was stare at the pages and caress them. That scene has never grown dim. Even today, when I look at the cover of that music, I am back again in that old musty shop with its faint smell of the sea. I hurried home, clutching the suites as if they were crown jewels. And once in my room, I pored over them. I read and reread them. I was 13 at the time, but for the following 80 years, the wonder of my discovery has continued to grow on me. Those suites opened up a whole new world. I began playing them with indescribable excitement. They became my most cherished music. I studied and worked at them every day for the next 12 years. Yes, 12 years would lapse before I became 25, before I had the courage to play one of the suites in public at a concert. Up until then, they had been considered academic works, mechanical without warmth. Imagine that. How could anyone think of them as being cold when a whole radiance of space and poetry pours forth from them? They are the very essence of Bach, and Bach is the essence of music."